You're listening to BFM 89.9, the business station.
Good morning, Frida Liu here with Helen Langhammer from Aspire Consulting in Raise Your Game. And we've been talking about HBDI, or the Herman Brain Dominance Instrument. And we've talked about how it can be used for individuals and teams in defining management and today and management leadership styles. And of course, today we're going to talk about two things, and how to use HBDI for recruiting the right people. And then you're going to talk about HBDI out of the corporate world and about how we can use it for managing relationships. A bit of a soft touch to that. And before we get into that, which will be very interesting, I'm sure, perhaps a quick recap of HBDI.
Okay, good morning, Frida. What is measured by the HBDI is our preference to think in a particular style. It's not a measure of our abilities, but rather how we prefer to think, whether we prefer to use the left side of our brain, the right side of our brain, the upper part, the cerebral part, or the lower part, the limbic part. Now, Ned Herman, who devised this model, theorized that we've got four distinct styles of thinking, which in his model are color-coded. So the left cerebral, the upper left, blue quadrant, deals with numbers, finance, and rational, logical, factual analysis. It also deals with goals and objectives. The left limbic, the lower green quadrant, focuses on putting things in order, in sequence, organizing, planning, administration. And this style of thinking is also focused on implementation, on getting things done, on procedure, on rules, and on safekeeping. The lower right, the limbic right, is the red quadrant. This style of thinking is focused on people, on emotions and feelings. It'll be concerned with empathy, enthusiasm and expressing, and also on spirituality and our musical appreciation. Now, finally, the right cerebral, the yellow D quadrant style of thought, is focused on the more long-term style of thinking, on strategic thought, big picture, and future orientation. Now, it's a style of thinking that's more spontaneous, impetuous, curious, artistic, and risk-taking. Now, each of us has got the ability to think in each of these styles, but over time we'll develop a preference for one or two or three of them. And how we prefer to think has an impact on how we communicate, how we work in teams, how we make decisions, and so forth.
So how can we use this for recruiting?
Okay, recruiting the right people should, in theory, be an exact science.
But in theory.
In theory. But quite often it's left up to how employers feel about each candidate, with little real analysis about what the job requires. Quite often people will recruit in their own likeness. So they'll see a candidate and think, this person's like me, so they must be good. Now, frequently, the person the same as the boss is not what the job requires. Now, take, for example, if you are a blue and yellow boss, you're very fact and figure driven, very goal orientated, and also focused on long-term strategy, on big picture thinking. And you're recruiting for the position of a PA. You don't want somebody who's also blue and yellow. You want somebody who can manage the details of your appointments, translate your yellow broad brush instructions into necessary actions and actually get on with the job and do them, and think about the details required in any situation, and also to provide a personal touch for dealings with people.
Thought of it that way.
Yeah. In short, you'd be looking for the opposite of blue and yellow, which is a red and green person. So you would want that person to complement your blue and yellow style. Now, imagine if your PA were blue and yellow. They would forget to put things in the diary, or they'd be constantly changing dates just for the hell of it, or they would be more task than people orientated. They'd be constrained by the details and the routine of the job, and they'd be unfulfilled because they wouldn't be playing to their strengths. Now, the trick is for employers is to assign jobs to employees, to assign them jobs that they find motivational, or to design a job that's aligned with their passion. That way, productivity will naturally increase because, as Confucius said, if we do what we love for a living, we'll never work a day in our lives.
All right. In this case then, so how do employers make sure that there is a fit between the job and the applicant?
Well, firstly, they need to be very clear about what the key requirements of the role are. Now, the blue and yellow manager needs to know that what he needs is not another blue and yellow person, but he needs a green and red detailed person. He needs to know what are the objectives of the role, what is the person expected to do and to achieve, how will their success be measured, what kind of work's involved, is it people-related or is it task-focused? Is it focused on details or operational procedures, or is it focused more on just strategic thought, on longer-term aspiration? Is creativity valued, or is perfecting an existing process more important? Now, all these factors should be taken into consideration, and the job itself given an HPDI profile. Let me give you a couple of examples. Now, if you imagine a hospital, what type of profile would each of these jobs be? A nurse. Now, a nurse is more likely to be
red
and green because she's good at detail, but she needs to be very good at patient care.
You wouldn't want a yellow nurse.
No, you wouldn't. Certainly not. I think I'll give him 50 milligrams of this rather than 10, because we'll see what happens. You know. Now, if you had chief of surgery, they're likely to be a left brain person, blue and green, but they'll also have that yellow focus because the chief of surgery would be looking to new developments in the surgery field. A paediatrician is more likely to have a red bent because they're dealing with children and need to persuade children to take their medicine and basically get along with kids. A pharmacist is more likely to be green and blue. Again, you wouldn't want a yellow pharmacist because they've got to be very detailed and very focused on the right dosage for the right patient. The director of customer service, again, would be very red and green. They're focused on people, and they would need to look at the details. So each of these jobs has got a different profile. And when you apply this model to a corporation, you can map out the profiles of each role and recruit to fit.
All right. So in this case, it'd be ideal if someone could do the thinking styles, profiling, before hiring a person.
Absolutely, yes.
Right.
Absolutely.
Okay. Other than profiling role, is there anything else the employer can do to make sure they get the right person?
Well, profiling the job is only one part of the equation. Employers should also pay attention to the team that they're recruiting for. If a team currently has a deficit of a particular colour, then employers should look for that too. Now, I'll give you another example. One of our clients currently is a pharmaceutical organisation, and they've recently been looking for a product manager to join their team. Now, ordinarily in FMCG marketing, the job of a product manager would be quite a yellow creative job. But in the pharmaceutical industry, there are a lot of restrictions on how products can be marketed. So the yellow creative style of thinking maybe isn't quite as important.
You'd think it'd be more important.
Well, it is important because they've got to think of ways around
the world, yes.
But they've really got to apply all the regulations in terms of advertising. So you would tend to find people who work in the pharmaceutical industry generally scoring high in blue because of the science bent required. Now, in this company, in the existing team of three, the profiles are skewed to the blue, with the yellow being the next highest. The green and red scores are relatively low. And when we analysed the existing team's profiles more deeply, we found that their yellow scores came more from strategic thought than creativity. And their moderate green scores were more the result of detailed thinking rather than implementation. So what is actually a key requirement for this department is that the new recruit should have a higher red score, because a lot of the work involved is persuading the sales force to take a course of action. And a relatively high green score they would need also, so that they can act as a conduit between marketing strategy and Salesforce implementation.
All right, and we'll be talking a little bit more about how HBDI can be used in recruiting. I'm speaking to Helen Langhammer from Aspire Consulting in Raise Your Game, BFM 89.9. Good morning, Frieda Liu here. If you've just joined us, I'm speaking to Helen Langhammer from Aspire Consulting in Raise Your Game. We've been talking about HBDI or thinking styles and how this can be used for recruiting. And also we'll touch a little bit about how this can help in managing relationships, and I can't wait to get to that bit. So let's still recruitment. I suppose matching the values in an organization with those a recruit would be important as well.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, the values that organizations espouse and the culture it promotes have to fit with those of the employees. You tend to find when companies merge or are acquired that a new set of values comes in, and it may not suit all of the existing employees. They may not feel comfortable working in an environment, for example, that promotes profit over people, or one that is too lax in terms of performance standards. So the values do have to match with the employee's values.
All right. So when the employer's done all this background work to determine the type of person they want, how do they ensure that they get the right person?
Well, for more senior positions, we would recommend that all of those who are shortlisted for interviews should be profiled, so that you've got an objective assessment of whether they'd be a good fit for the requirements of that role. we can see if there's a match between the job profile and the candidate's profile. Then interviewers should spend time analysing the resumes and the profile and devise a series of questions that's really going to uncover the temperament, aptitudes and behavioural traits that will determine the candidate's ultimate suitability for the role.
Right, so there are other things to consider as well.
Yeah,
as you
there
mentioned,
are.
Aptitudes,
absolutely.
Temperament. And what about experience? Isn't that important as well?
Well, yes, experience is important, but not as important as you might think. It's not certainly as important as how good a fit the candidate is with, for example, the team they're going to be working with or with the values of the organisation. So let's go back to the pharmaceutical example. Now, if the person applying for the job has pharmaceutical experience, that would be a bonus, but it's not essential because what they'll need to learn about all the products they're going to be promoting anyway. So, it's not essential that they have pharmaceutical experience. What would be more important is their aptitude. Do they have the will to learn? Is their thought process in alignment with the requirements of the job? Do their values fit that of the organisation? Do they have the right temperament for this team? Would they be an effective complement to this team? All of these things are of much greater importance than someone's experience.
All right. And what does the company need to do in terms of asking questions and all that?
Well, what they need to do really is prepare well for an interview. I've sat in a number of interviews where people have said, oh, well, what are we going to ask this person? You know, it requires a lot more thought and preparation because it's a big investment hiring someone. So, you know, it deserves
And if you make the wrong person.
Yeah, it can, you make the wrong choice, it can be very costly. So if you're recruiting for a job, for example, which problem-solving skills are important, you could ask, tell me about a time when you were faced with a problem at work. How did you go about solving it? And follow up with who else was involved? How did you manage their role? What mistakes did you make? What did you learn and how would you avoid making them? Or you could ask, tell me about a problem that you failed to solve. What steps did you take and why? What would you do differently next time? Too often, recruiters will ask about the tasks or duties on a top-line basis only. They'll ask about experience, qualifications and skills, rather than delving deeper and asking about how that experience, those qualifications and skills have been used. They should focus more on what motivates and spurs the candidate into action, what demotivates them, and what are the values that are important to them, and so on.
You know, when you talk about asking a question, like, tell me about a problem you failed to solve.
Yeah.
You're not going to get an honest answer.
Actually,
I can see the reasoning behind it. So you just want to know the person's thinking style. But, you know, I would
like to think that you should get an honest answer because if the job that you're recruiting for is one that's focused on problem solving, everyone is going to have solved every single problem in their lives. And what that question will uncover is the person's thought process and their understanding of why the problem failed, because that in itself is important, is that self-knowledge. To understand why they failed and what they would do differently next time.
Some people probably get it wrong and think, well, you know, I can't...
I've never had a problem that I haven't solved.
I'm next to perfection.
Yes.
All right. And we'll go into how do you use this in relationships?
Well, this is the interesting part that I know you've been waiting for. So, you know, it can be used in relationships because when we understand that our partners and loved ones have got a different thinking style from us and are just not being bloody-minded or deliberately obtuse, we can develop a lot more patience in our relationships.
Compassion.
Yeah. Our brains are different physiologically, and there are typical male and female brain dominance patterns that affect our behaviour. Now, bear in mind that the descriptions I'm about to give are extremes, and men and women can be anywhere on the spectrum. Mm. You can have some men who've got more female brains. You've got some females who have got more male brains. So it's nothing to do with their sexuality.
It's very interesting you say more male brains, more female brains. So, okay, what do you mean by that? Female would be more reds. That's what I'm thinking.
Absolutely, yes. And how that manifests itself is in how we resolve problems, for example. Now, if we talk about physiology first, the physiology of the brains are different. Men have got bigger brains than us women.
Okay.
So what? I mean, the creature with the biggest brain in the world is the blue whale, and I haven't seen too many Nobel Prize winning blue whales. So size is not important when it comes to brain size. Now, what is important is that there are the two hemispheres of the brain, the left hemisphere and the right hemisphere, and what connects them is a series of fibres called the corpus callosum. Now, if you imagine it as a dial-up connection, women have got a real high-speed dial-up connection. Men, there are real high-speed internet connections. Men have got
still dial-ups.
Men are still on two tin cans and a piece of string. Actually, I'm exaggerating. Women have got about 10% more of this corpus callosum. Mm. Now, how that manifests itself is that women tend to use both sides of their brains when it comes to making decisions. So they will mull over a decision more than a man will. So if you need a decision making fast or urgently, a man is going to be better at doing it. But if you need a decision given full thought.
You're right.
A woman is probably going to be the better one to do it.
Faster decision doesn't mean the right decision.
Absolutely, yes. But I speak as a woman.
Right. Okay, we tend to be a little biased here.
No, you mentioned about red and blue. Women do tend to be skewed towards the red, and men do tend to be skewed towards the blue. So that has an impact on how we see problems. So imagine you've got a woman who comes home from work, and she's had a really, really tough day at work, and she comes home and says to her husband, "I've had a terrible day. He did this, she did that. He said this, she said that. It was just awful, blah, 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 blah." And the husband will say, "I don't see what your problem is. What you want to do is A, B, and C." And the wife then says, "I don't know why I even bother speaking to you. You just don't understand." Now, that's a manifestation of our red skew as women and our blue skew as men, because men's brains are hardwired to solve problems. Women just want to talk about them, which is why they'll go out for coffee with their girlfriends and they'll talk about them, and their girlfriends will say, "Oh, I know, isn't he awful? Oh, that's terrible." Whereas their partner is unlikely to be hardwired to be able to do that.
I guess also when you find women that might be more blue and yellow, we tend to give them names.
Some of us might, yes.
Some of us might.
I mean, as I said, this is this is not really to do with our sexuality. It's to do with how our brains are sexed. That they are physiologically
different.
And
it's not a man versus woman conversation. It's just how it is.
It is, yes, absolutely.
Right.
I think
scientifically proven.
We're going to get along much better as men and women if we accept that we are equal but different, rather than fighting all the time to be more like men, because women are not like men. They're different. Okay. Now, in terms of, for example, competitiveness versus collaboration, women are more able to collaborate than men. Men naturally are more competitive. Now, obviously, in some sports, you'll see some extremely competitive women. So this is just a spectrum of behaviours. But generally speaking, women tend to be more collaborative. They're more natural team workers than are men. Now, there was an experiment done in the UK a number of years ago that showed that this behaviour starts very young. And they got a group of children aged about six. They got a group of boys and a group of girls. And the only instruction was they gave them a viewfinder. And the only instruction was share it so that everyone can see. So the girls sat in a circle and they all looked through this viewfinder and they talked to each other and they said, "Oh, I like that picture. What did you like? Oh, I like that picture too." And they managed the task no problem. They gave it to the boys. Guess what happened? Within minutes, they were fighting with one another. They had to be the first. They had to have it. You know, they just could not collaborate. Now, that's an extreme example. But in a workplace, you'll tend to find that women are more able to collaborate than are men.
All right. Any final words on HBDI?
Well, there's a number of other differences between men and women I'd like to talk about too, because I don't want to give the impression that I'm completely biased and saying that women are great and men are rotten, because it's not the case. In terms of spatial awareness,
I was happy to stop there.
In terms of spatial awareness, men are much better than women. They're much better able to manipulate shapes in their brain. Now, you might say to yourself, "Well, what good is that?"
Yeah.
Think about when you're traveling somewhere and using a map. Do you need to turn the map in the direction that you're facing? Because most women do. Most men are not able to. Most women will have difficulty also in judging the space between two cars to understand whether their car will park and fit neatly. Men can do that no bother at all. So their spatial awareness is much better than women's. Final one I'd like to speak about, and this is one where women are better than men, is multitasking. Women are much better at multitasking than men are. Men are far better at focusing absolutely on one issue, whereas women are better at multitasking. Now, this arises from years and years and years ago when we operated as cavemen and cavewomen. The men were the ones who went out and focused singularly on hunting, bringing food back, whereas the women were in the caves doing cave paintings, doing a little bit of dusting, looking out for predators. So they had to have broader peripheral vision. They had to do a number of things at once, whereas the men focused purely on one thing.
And I think it comes back to, what was that terminology, corpus callosum. So it comes back to that.
It does, absolutely, yeah. The women tend to use more of their brain to do more than one thing at once. Now, most women I know can watch television, read a magazine, and take a phone call at the same time.
Yeah.
Now, they'll not be giving their full attention to all of those tasks, but they can pretty much do it. Most men they find that very difficult.
They find it
very hard. Now, why I say the HBDI can help in a relationship is that just as in a corporate team, the idea in a relationship is to play to your strengths and to realize that you are different. And to be a little bit flexible and understand the colour of your partner's worldview. So if you understand, for example, that your wife is always going to want to talk about her problems without necessarily finding a solution, then let her talk. Just listen.
Right. And say yes, dear, every minute or so.
Something like that, yes. Would you like a cup of tea, dear? Maybe give her a shoulder massage or something. Don't be tempted to solve her problems because she's not going to be interested. Similarly, if you know that your husband is incapable of multitasking, don't ask him to do it. It's only going to end in tears, right. And they're most likely going to be yours. So.
So those were the final wise words from Helen Langhammer, Aspire Consulting. We've been talking about HBDI and thinking styles. And tomorrow, I'll be seeing Shankar Santiram from EQ Training Development. And, of course, this will be the series on the 10 Laws of Making Teams Work based on John C. Maxwell's work. And tomorrow he'll be talking on the law of the niche. BFM 89.9.
BFM 89.9, the business station.